Hi there, it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. You may know me from my podcast called Wiser Than Me, where I talk to older women and get their wisdom from the front lines of life. I was amazed by how many people told me our show made them look forward to getting older, which is why I'm here to talk about season two of the show. Sally Field, Billie Jean King, Beverly Johnson, Ina Garten, Bonnie Raitt, just to name a few. All hail old women. Wiser Than Me season two is out now from Lemonada Media.
Hey, Expanse fans, and welcome to episode two of The Churn. And this week, we're going to break down episode three of The Expanse, episode titled Static.
I'm Cher Martinetti, and with me is...
Adam Swiderski.
And we're going to be joined by creators Ty Frank and Daniel Abraham. And we, spoiler alert, are going to be spoiling the episode, because obviously we're
all
doing...
All to hell.
Going to totally ruin it for you guys. So if you haven't seen it yet... pause this, go watch it right now, and then come back and join us for the conversation. Or while you're doing that, you can hop onto iTunes, make sure you're subscribing to our podcast, and you want to give us 5 stars because we're swell and so are you. So really quick, let's recap where we are this week's episode.
Wait, there's one more thing to say.
What? Well, I'm going to get there.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I jumped the gun. Go ahead.
You know, okay.
Recap.
So this week, Miller finds himself on the outs. Once again, Christian commits treason by extending an olive branch of sorts to Fred Johnson, and the honeymoon might already be over for Holden and Naomi because they're slowly starting to enter the it's complicated territory. And Amos, who, spoiler alert, is going to be joining us later. Wes is going to be here, not here, but in spirit. He's going to be here. But Amos shows us that it takes a psychopath to know a psychopath, and... leads up some pretty impressive questioning of a prisoner. So what was your favorite part of the episode this week?
Well, geez, it was an interesting kind of a breath to take after the big epic space battle that ended episode two. I'm on board with Frankie Adams as Bobby Draper. I love everything having to do with the Martian Marines, their whole little group interplay. And her cold cocking the hell out of the character whose name I can't remember, but he's like, he was born on Mars. He wasn't born on Mars.
He was born on Earth, he's an immigrant. Grew up on Mars.
And,
which is very timely.
You get to see Frankie Adams boxer throw a serious cross.
That was a beautiful punch she threw.
It was.
Because I even saw it and I was like, that form was so perfect.
So that was certainly great. And then the creepiness of Cortazar, who is the researcher from the station from last week, who they captured on Tycho Station and are interrogating, was just awesomely executed. So I was psyched for that.
I have to say, I think... one of the things to me that was really interesting, and I'm definitely going to want to talk to Ty and Daniel about, is the whole part with Miller talking to that Mormon priest. And then definitely, again, I agree with you with the interrogation. Amos really showed a totally different side of himself this episode. And I think that, you know, they often say that sociopaths and psychopaths are actually very intelligent. And I think we're starting to see that, you know... there is an intelligence there with Amos that initially, maybe in the first season, you would not think existed.
Plus, we got some belter dubstep. I think we need to use that as the theme song for the podcast.
I mean, we'll have to talk about that
later. The screams of the dying of Eros.
Yeah. Very chipper song. With that, let's say hi to Ty and Daniel. Hi, guys.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. So obviously, you heard our little spiel. What was your favorite part of this episode, watching it?
I kind of love that last moment with Miller on in the control room saying that he has a plan now. You know, that kind of reveal that everything we saw with the Mormon missionary and the talking about the Nauvoo wasn't what it looked like at the time. I love that payoff.
It's always nice for me to see those moments where Miller kind of gets it together, because we see him be a mess so much.
And then, they're so few and far
between. Yeah, well, no. And then suddenly it's like you see how formidable a person he actually is. I really enjoy that.
Yeah, I'm on board with Frankie punching people. And in fact, this entire season,
I think we wrote around finding reasons to have Frankie punch people.
I don't blame you.
I'm so excited to hear that. That's great. We should have like some sort of at the end of the season of the podcast, like ranking Frankie's punches, knockout punches.
Yeah. There are some awesome ones coming up. This thinking forward. Yeah,
this is not the last phase she will cave in this season.
No. I want to put in an honorable mention for the post stress montage with the dancing and Alex going back and doing the firing sequences and watching the prisoners and brooding. I thought that came together.
Yeah, actually, talking about, well. I absolutely agree. And talking about favorite things this episode, I do love watching Frankie punch people, but one of my other favorite things is the relative newcomer to the show, Kara G, who's playing Drummer, the head of security on Tycho, a character from much later in the books that we pulled forward because we really had a need for a character like that in the series. And all of her interactions with Naomi are fantastic. I just love the two of them together. We through the season, we give more time for the two of them to hang out together. And one of the really cool things that Kara's doing here is she has one of my favorite Belter accents because she sounds like English is her second language. She always sounds really uncomfortable when she's saying her lines in English, but every time she switches to Belter, she's smooth and flowing. And it's like, it's nobody ever says it, but it's such an obvious English as second language interpretation of the character that I thought it was a really brilliant move performance-wise on her part. I think she does a fantastic job with it.
Yeah, it was not something I remember ever talking about, and I didn't even notice it until we started looking at the cuts and was pointed out. But yeah, she's made some really interesting choices. Yeah.
I have to say, I really, you know, speaking of her relationship with Naomi, I really enjoy how, you know, their way of blowing off steam is like, let's go play ball and then let's go drink some beers. And it's so not this like gender norm of like what people would be like, oh, when girls are upset, they're going to sit home and like eat ice cream. Like it's much more, you know, it definitely fits the characters, but I think it's a little more honest. That is a way that they're going to blow off steam.
There's room for all kinds of people with all kinds of things they love to do. But I got to say, Drummer and Naomi are the last two characters who will blow off steam by going purse shopping. Yeah.
Watching Space Love Actually.
Listen, don't knock.
You know, I can imagine.
I would watch Space Love Actually, but I would also go play like a sport and hit people.
Yeah, I want to talk about Space Handball because, man, it's such a tricky thing to create a science fiction sport. On the worst end, you can end up with Ambo Jitsu from Star Trek The Next Generation, which I don't know if you guys are familiar with that particular moment. But was there something you visualized when it came to this, or are you anticipating this like being something that fans kind of embrace?
No, this episode was written by Robin Weiss, a co-EP on our show. She was the one who suggested, because we were trying to figure out what they could do together that would be sort of a Belter kind of activity. And she was the one that suggested handball. And her reason for that was Belters live in small confined spaces with lots of walls. They basically live in handball courts. And handball requires nothing other than that you own a ball. So it doesn't require any expensive equipment or anything like that. And because of the way gravity is generated on space stations through spin, the movement of the ball will be it will always be curved, but will always be curved in predictable curves if you know the spin of the station. So it's a thing that Belters will be good at because they live on these stations and predicting the curve of objects in Coriolis is just something they do naturally. But people who aren't from Belt stations won't be good at. So it kind of sets them apart as a group. So I thought it was a brilliant idea. I mean, Robin's a fantastic writer, and a lot of great stuff in the show comes from her, and this was one of her ideas.
See, and this is what I love about this show and this universe in particular, is because it's one scene, you know, primarily expository. You know, you get a little bit of the handball action, but so much thought went into the science behind it and why it makes sense. I think that's really cool.
Like, who picked the song that was being played?
The Eros dubstep
yes.
torture mix.
My understanding is that that was composed by Clinton, our musical composer. That, you know, they provided some sound effects of the sort of the dying voices of Eros that he then worked into the musical piece of it.
I just love that because I feel like that's something that would actually happen.
Yeah.
You know, it's like people with all the maker culture and everything that's out there, people are taking all this media stuff and warping it into entertainment. I thought that was really a nice touch.
My only issue with that is that I'm concerned that people think dubstep will still be around that far in the future. But
I want to, that does bring up one thing to me. I mean, that character, and I should know his name from the credits, but I don't.
It's like Diago or something like that?
Yeah, the boy
Diogo?
Who's Miller's friend.
Diago.
Yeah, Diago, thank you. And
yeah.
And Cortazar was such like interesting, developed, what you would call, I guess, minor characters. I mean, they're not part of the main cast. They're not the main supporting characters. Can you guys talk about the importance of those characters in the show and why so much goes into developing them the way they are?
Well, a lot of them are characters who existed in the books and short stories. So the backstories of them, the ways that they interact with the world are things that we have often have pre-cooked. Diogo was a character in Leviathan. He wasn't a major character, but he was somebody who was there, and we're seeing kind of this version of his interactions with Miller. And they're a little different, but they're related. And Cortazar is the main character in one of the novellas, The Vital Abyss. And we pulled him forward here because we realized that we could, and some interesting things would come from that. So with all of that, we have the advantage of having thought through and developed just a lot of this beforehand.
Yeah, and you've got to give a lot of credit to the performers there, too. Andrew Attilio, who plays Diogo, is a young guy. I think we may be his first or second acting job, but he really dove into the material and engaged with it, and spent a lot of time with the dialect guy who was teaching, you know, Belter lingo and stuff, really spent a lot of time with him and really has just thrown himself into the part. And then I apologize because his name just flew out of my head, but the gentleman who's playing Cortazar is a really talented stage actor who also does screen work, but has that sort of subtlety to his performance that I think really drives home how creepy Cortazar is as a character. And I mean, I don't think a lot of people could have pulled it off as well as he did. We do a lot of work to try to make sure they're interesting characters on the page, but those two performers are really just knocking those parts out of the park.
And Cortazar came to play. He came having read the short story and with questions for us about the character's background. One of the things that we mention in the short story is that that character's, Cortazar's boyfriend in the story mentions that he's named after two writers, and the actor wanted to, you know, he knew one of the writers that was being referenced, but wanted to know who the other one was. And that's a level of detail coming in on the first day that means you came ready to play. You came.
Yeah, he really did his homework.
So let me ask you a question. In the books, Cortazar is gay.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, are we going to actually, is that going to play into the show at all? Is that going to be shown in the show at all? Because I know that, you know, with Battlestar Galactica, we never saw that Gaeta was gay or got the chance to have a relationship, even though I think in like one of the extras you found out that he was.
I mean, we certainly, in the case of a character like Cortazar, we're not going to write around creating a scene just for that. I mean, it would have to be sort of, I think, organic to the story going forward. If Cortazar shows up in the third season and we have more stuff for him to do, we certainly would not shy away from it. We're very committed to not, you know, shying away from that kind of stuff. You know, in the first season we had Ambassador DeGrasse and his husband,
and we had Saeed in the Martian.
Saeed mentions that he's gay when he's talking to, you know, in one of the conversations
in episode one.
In episode one. So that kind of stuff, we're never going to shy away from it. In the case of Cortazar, him being a prisoner of the OPA may lead to limited, you know.
Yeah, there are no Tinder hookups in the OPA.
Yeah, limited options for romance there. But, you know, if it came up, we wouldn't shy away from it.
Yeah, just hot bench smacking action. That's all. You just smack someone with a bench. That's the closest you get.
You know what? Do not mess with that guy's stuff.
Obviously, he's got some latent anger issues that he needs to work out. Speaking of people with anger issues that are a little, you know, intense, I think Wes is on the line now. Are you there, Wes?
Yes, I am. Hey, guys. How you doing?
Hello.
Hey, Wes.
Welcome.
Hey, what's going on, Ty? How are you?
I'm doing great.
Now, I want to say... I disagree with anger issues. I don't know if Amos really feels that, you know, type of anger or whatever. He's just he's a practical survivor and does what he has to do. But a lot of emotion is not involved in how he handles situations.
I'm gonna back Wes on that one. Amos gets a lot of armchair diagnoses that I think are a little bit off.
Yeah.
But I enjoy that. I think, you know, what was a lot of fun for me in the first season is, you know, slowly building this character. And I love the name of this podcast, by the way. And The Churn is really my blueprint of how I created or, you know, how we kind of created Amos. And it's the kind of it's the center of him and how he operates now. You know, based off The Churn and building this character and then coming in episode one, you don't really get in depth of Amos or what's going on. And then it's really fun to see what, you know, how people quickly kind of judge how he's ticking or how he's thinking, which I think is really interesting.
We were talking about favorite scenes, and I wanted to mention there's a really excellent scene of the doctor describing what has been sort of surgically done to Cortazar and watching Amos's reactions to that information and the kinds of questions he asks is a really, I think, a really interesting and subtle insight into how he sees himself.
Well, I was going to also bring up that there's a part in the episode where when he's explaining to Holden, like when you're questioning a pedophile, you talk to them in a certain way. And I think making that, you know, drawing that distinction between the two of them, or not distinction, but kind of like drawing that correlation between the two of them, you know, that wouldn't have been something super obvious to someone that's not tuned in to something on another level. So I think that's where you start seeing there's these flashes of intelligence that, you know, people don't expect Amos to have. Like, do think that he's just like a grunt and he's just going to go, you know, oh, it's time to beat someone up, so I'm going to beat somebody up. But I think because he is a little more buttoned up and he doesn't really wear any emotion on his sleeve, you don't realize what's actually like simmering under the surface with him.
Yeah. And what I find, what I found really interesting about Amos and what really drew me to Amos in the beginning is that he doesn't have an ego in that way. He doesn't see himself as a, you know, tough guy trying to be tough. He sees himself as somebody that is ultimately a survivor first. He's very tribal in the people that are close to him. And when there is a threat, he systematically takes care of that threat. And it, you know, it all stems from him having to survive in a very hostile environment as a kid. And you know, I actually talked to, I had a therapist read The Churn, and we had a long conversation about what would be going on with this guy. And there was a lot of reading about attachment disorders and definitely PTSD from his childhood and the kind of way that he's lived his life. But one of his guiding principles is he doesn't want to be the men that abused him and somebody that's very important to him, Lydia, and his natural birth mother when he was growing up. And that is kind of, and he knows that that line he could easily cross, and he does cross sometimes, but he doesn't have the kind of moral compass to see or to understand that he has crossed that line. And, you know, to me, that's really interesting going into that.
Well, and speaking of that, I, you know, one of the interesting things we start to see about Amos in this episode, I feel like, you know, we knew he had his attachment to Naomi and kind of her guidance. And here in his conversation with Miller, we start to see that he's starting to feel that way towards Holden or look to Holden mm-hmm. in terms of leadership. Can mm-hmm. you talk a bit about that relationship and how that's developed?
Well, I think, you know, I think it's Holden specifically, but it's also to the crew as well. I think that going through what they went through in the first season, you know, of course, his relationship to Naomi was his most important relationship. But what they went through as a crew and how Holden and over and over again, he felt made the right choice, did the right thing, is somebody that he could really count on and really trust with everybody else in the Rossi crew as well. And so he it starts to become a part of his tribe. In season two, Naomi does some things that are out of his expectations and start to challenge the way he sees her, and he sees the world through her. And it's really unsettling and disturbing to him. And as he's trying to grab a hold of something that's stable, there's Holden, and Holden has always been, you know, Holden for whatever reason is always steady and holding his course. And that's the kind of thing that Naomi kind of gravitates towards. But he's also, you know, wants to protect, the second season, his relationships kind of broadened to the rest of the Rossinati crew, and he wants to really protect his tribe. And if Naomi's making decisions that could put the tribe in jeopardy, it's really going to have to challenge the way he sees her and how he sees the world through her.
We had some people on Twitter ask some questions. Actually, you actually answered some of those questions without even being asked them. But mm-hmm. some people wanted to know, like, what were some performances that you watched to help you, if there were any, to kind of help you when you were preparing for Amos?
I don't really prepare in that way. But in saying that, you know, I'm a big fan of great actors and great performances. So I'm sure subconsciously there are certain roles and certain things that kind of have come through in what I've done. But I haven't really looked at something specifically to base it off of. I did know that I wanted to make a direct decision and honor the churn and kind of the Amos that was created and not let him be, you know, the tough guy number four in the background with the witty, you know, one-two line. I was more fascinated in the possibility of what he is in the churn and how we can bring that to life with the show.
And I guess following on that, Ty and Daniel, when you were writing the character, were there any influences that came up with that or anything you were looking particularly to bring across?
Well, first, who writes for Amos? Because I know you guys split up the characters in the book. So who writes Amos mostly?
We both write everybody to some degree. But
when I get the lines wrong, Ty is the one who fixes the Amos lines.
I jokingly say Amos is my id. there was this moment as a younger person where I could have gone a much more Amos-y route and fortunately didn't. When we were casting Amos, so this was way, way, way at the beginning of the process. We had a lot of people come in and read for the part. And the mistake that almost all of them made was they read him as a tough guy. They got really growly voiced and they got really threatening and they, you know, playing him as a very standard tough guy. Wes was the one who came in and he read the most threatening dialogue in the same tone of voice you would use to ask somebody what time it is. There was no emotion in it. It's just, yeah, so now I'm going to have to like tear your helmet off and throw you off the ship and kill you. But it was just kind of flat and factual. And it became very clear, like immediately, that he was the one who understood the character. And this was before we knew he had read the books and done this research and stuff. He just understood the character right from the start. And once we'd seen those auditions, there was just no doubt that he was the guy.
There's a lot of turnover in the creative team when you're doing a show like this. And you know, we get a new director every couple episodes. We had some folks come in and out from the first to second season. And Wes, understanding Amos as well as he does, has really let him be sort of the guardian and protector of Amos, so that, that, you know, if anybody comes in and hasn't kind of clocked that this isn't just another tough guy, Wes is always there to kind of keep that authentic and to say, no, this is not what would be going on with Amos. And here's how Amos would approach it. And his instincts on that are always just dead on.
And I think one of the things that makes this a unique situation is that usually when there's a show based upon books, the authors aren't as intimately involved as we are lucky to have with Ty and Daniel. And so when they're on set and when they're involved with writing the scripts and the creative process, in the very beginning of the first season, I read The Churn. And so when we started in the first episode, there was a different kind of creative vision, which I can understand. Amos is complex and it takes you have to really look at it deep, but we kind of had different ideas in the beginning. And then when they sit down with Ty and Daniel there to be able to explain to them, to have them back you up and your kind of creative choices, was very, very valuable. And we were able to stay as faithful to the books because they were, involved in the process.
Wes, are you all caught up with the books now or no?
No, I'll read a book a season. I don't want to get too far ahead, and I kind of like to stay, moment to moment and kind of be living it, through in the present time. But, and also too, when I get too far ahead, I mean, when I started reading the first season, I read the first book and then I started reading the second book. And I started, referencing things that haven't happened in the show, but they would have happened at that timeline in the book, just small things. And they're saying, no, that's the book. That's not the show. So I got easily confused. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to read a book a season, process it, then go do the show and kind of have it separate.
We had another question on Twitter. People were saying, or somebody said that they were much more excited for Amos and Miller's relationship than Naomi and Holden's. So they wanted to know, on a scale of 1 to 10, how colorful will that relationship be?
So they know about me and Miller's romance?
Exactly.
It's out there.
Yeah. The sparks. And that scene in the bar, were flying.
This last week with Dominique, and the consensus was that Amos can be shipped with anybody. So...
And you know what? The steam that Miller and I have in this season, I think, would rival Naomi and Holden's romantic relationship. No, I'm just kidding.
Really?
No. I think Miller and I's relationship really definitely comes to a head in episode 2. Simatimba, Miller's partner, threatened Naomi. In that situation, he has to go. And that was very clear and that was very practical to me. I didn't have anything against Miller. I don't have, that sort of feelings towards him. But Miller obviously has something against Amos. And Amos understands that kind of resentment and that kind of tension that Miller's giving me, especially when we're in all of these type of situations, we're barely hanging on to our lives. That's dangerous, and that's dangerous for the survival of the crew. So he starts to press Miller to really see, where Miller's at, and also to deal with the situation immediately in whatever form that, in however that means, whatever shape that takes. If Miller needs to go, then he needs to go. I mean, I think Amos, in a lot of ways, kind of likes the way Miller does business. I think that they see things and they see some things very similar. So, he doesn't have really anything against them, but when he starts behaving the way he behaves, it puts everybody in danger, and you can't have that. So it definitely comes to a head in season 2. And then you'll see, the aftermath and how that progresses between us and, how that plays out in the relationships in the rest of the season.
Can you talk a bit about playing that scene in the bar specifically? One of my favorite scenes from the last episode was after Miller shoots Dresden and just walks away without saying anything. And I felt that was kind of mirrored a little bit because Amos sits down with Miller and Miller goes to toast him and he just starts drinking. I thought that was a really funny moment. Can you talk a bit about that interplay with Thomas Jane there and what it was like making that scene?
Yes, I think that, I think Amos's understanding of that scene is that, I agree 100%. I think Miller did the right thing. I think that the things that Dresden was doing was is punishable in one way. And the fact that it's a really real possibility that he could have gotten away with that. And so Miller did the right thing and Amos would have done that and backed him up in that situation. But what Miller doesn't understand is Holden does not think that way. He doesn't operate that way. And so he's really just pointing out the difference of what, you know, how Holden thinks and who Holden is as opposed to him. And Holden is my tribe. You know, Holden is my new, you know, so I'm going to back Holden's decision or whatever it is. And he says he's out and he's out.
I know you said that you did a lot of, you had a therapist read The Churn and you talked about like PTSD and Dominique last week really said that the way you've analyzed and like really dove headfirst into Amos's character has actually helped them with understanding that character too. But when you're going that deep in such heavy material,
does the abyss stare into you?
Yes.
As well?
do you start to be like, all right, I need to like just completely... You know, how do you reverse whatever
you have
heaviness?
To decompress from Amos?
Yeah.
I always look at each situation or each thing I go into. It's kind of like a sounding board and, the big sounding boards where they mix music. Mm-hmm. And I first look at all the levels that are very similar to me that I have in common with the character I'm about to play. And so you see, and then I keep those the same. And then I look at the things that are different. You got to turn those, you got to turn some things up. You got to bring some things down. And you try to find a way to bring yourself to this character under these circumstances. And so with Amos, I found our similarities first. And then I started, working the board to kind of get me to where his mindset was. And there definitely is your personality does change a little bit. And you do kind of express... Amos, the kind of aggression and the kind of the way that you train for him, there's a physical training that I do to kind of get in that mindset. And it does kind of rub off on you. And there are areas. But as soon as it's, even talking about it now, I mean, it's been how many months has it been since we, it's been how many months has it been?
You guys wrapped fall, right?
Yeah. So it's been a while now. So even talking about it, and knowing that I was doing working on other things and kind of, even talking about it now, I do kind of feel a little bit distant from it. Like I don't feel as connected to it. Whereas when I'm in the process or when I'm working on it, it's easy. I don't even really talk about it in the third person. I would just say, I have this relationship with Naomi. I have this, I try to make it as, it's the power of the imagination. Try to make those circumstances as real to me as possible and as close to me as possible. So I feel like there's something really at stake that I'm really fighting for something in each scene to make happen. So to answer your question, it does rub off a little bit, but I'm not going to go kill anybody. but
that's
I might
good
be a little
hear.
Less, I might have a little less need to please or need to fit in.
That is actually a lie because Wes almost killed me with tequila once.
Yeah, I heard you guys definitely know how to blow off steam when you're shooting.
I think, and I'm not exaggerating, I think Ty's bar bill was $1,500.
I think that it's probably, from what I know of Ty, I don't know that it was all you doing the bad influence. I think it might have been Ty doing it.
Oh, no. This was all Ty's idea.
Yeah.
He's the one who did the whole thing. No. I was a victim in this.
I believe you. I believe you 100%.
So we've talked a lot about The Churn, the novella, and, last season we saw some scenes from Butcher of Anderson Station realized on screen when we were talking about Fred Johnson's backstory. Can we expect, I guess without giving any spoilers away, and this might be for Ty and Daniel or also for Wes, can we expect to see anything from The Churn show up on screen this season or in the future?
I would go with the never say never. I'm not going to make any promises though.
Okay. I mean, Wes, are you ready? Are you ready for the Amos spinoff show? I guess is what I'm asking.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think the Churn would make a great film.
Sci-fi films.
That would be awesome.
Bring that right upstairs.
Yeah, we'll bring that right upstairs to the big leagues of sci-fi and see if we can get that greenlit.
Wes, what's so far been your favorite in this season? I mean, I know that by the time this podcast comes out, it's just the third episode. So what's been your favorite, without any spoilers, of this season shooting or even just watching? What's been your favorite part?
I think I was really blown away by the space battle. I think it was in the end of episode two.
Yeah.
Right before they shot Dresden. I mean, I'm a sci-fi fan, and I've always been a fan of the genre. And I was huge. Like, I loved Alien. I loved all Aliens. I loved Blade Runner. I loved, you know, everything about it. And so to be a part of something like this, I was a Battlestar fan as well, but to be a part of something like this, and that I really respect and I really enjoy being able to watch those epic space battles and being in space, you know, getting to work. It's just that I love that. I love that aspect of it. I think the visual effects are amazing on this. I mean, I can't wait, because I've seen up to episode six so far, and I think the bar has really been raised this season, and I'm really excited for everybody to see what Bob Monroe and his crew have done with the visual effects in this season two. It's like, I can't wait to see Ganymede, and it's really impressive.
Speaking in particular about that space battle, we had a conversation last week about you getting slammed around during the during the point we were trying to repair the ship, and you're in that walkway or that whole space, whatever. Can you talk a bit about that experience and wanting to, because they mentioned that they couldn't pull you out of there.
Yes, you know, we talked about my favorite thing in the season. Let's talk about my most unfavorite thing in the season. Least favorite. You know, it's funny because Breck Eisner was directing that episode, and Breck Eisner is very detail oriented, very, very particular, and he takes his time setting up the shots, and so there, you know, we had these two they created these two walls that I'm basically in between, and that they're going to slam me. But we were in the jumbo stage, and the jumbo, jumbo stage is
it's
huge.
Enormous.
It is,
I saw
massive.
It. Yeah.
It's enormous. It's like, I don't even know how high it is or whatever. But so I was at the very, so they hoisted me up in a harness, and I'm upside down, and they take you to the very top of the jumbo stage, and you have all, you know, had all the space suit on, all the equipment on, and I'm hanging upside down up there. And Brett gets so focused on the lighting and the smoke and making sure this is right and everything. And I'm, you know, then they're going to hoist me down, and I grab and I'm putting the pipes together, and all of a sudden they're going to start slamming back and forth. And that's, you know, they're preparing for the shot. So as I'm up there upside down, and Brett's, you know, focused on the light, he's focused on the smoke, he's focused on this. And at this point, you know, being up there for about 5-10 minutes, the blood starts going to the head, and I'm just hanging. Everybody forgets about you way at the top up there. And I'm, you know, I'm looking down. It's hard to explain how high it is. And I'm up there, and I'm looking down, and blood's going to my face. And he's like, you know what? Let's get this smoke, or let's get this. This is not enough, and this lighting. And finally, I was like, guys. And they're like, oh, we're so sorry. Wait. You know, so there's a few times where they forgot about me up there, and, you know, hanging from that harness upside down with, you know, blood going to the head. But, you know, it was a funny day. It was a good time. This whole show has been, this really, you know, I do, you know, it was funny because we're talking about, you asked me earlier about if Amos rubs off. And in some ways he does rub off, but in some ways I kind of rebel against it. And we get really silly on set, and there's a lot of, you know, playing around and joking. And it's a really good group of guys and to be around. It's been this whole thing has been a real pleasure to be a part of.
You know, all the stories that I do hear, the stories, the few or many, whatever, it definitely sounds like you guys get along great and really do find a way to lighten the heaviness. The season looks so great so far, and I'm so excited for people to start seeing it, because I definitely think season two is going to be like...
How many have you seen so far?
Unless Bob Monroe runs out of money in the second half of the season.
Why would you say that? Because that affects us too. Stop it.
Then we revert to flying saucers on
screens. Right, and then all of a sudden, it's like, the 60s Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, like Claymation.
Yes, yes, I have all those movies. Those are the best movies. I'm only up to season three. I haven't gotten...
Episode three,
sorry. I haven't gotten past that yet. I have the episodes, but I'm trying... I'm kind of like how you are with the books. Like, I don't like to go too far ahead with stuff because then I'm like, I get too anxious, like waiting for the next one sometimes. So I try to purposely like space myself out.
Both you guys are on episode three?
That's right.
Yeah. He knows. I mean,
I've read the books and all the novellas and everything. So I kind of know what's coming somewhat, but I'm really, I mean, it's kind of like reading about the Grand Canyon versus seeing it, you know?
And I know what's coming up.
Right.
I also just keep hearing from like other people at sci-fi that like it gets ridiculous, like that, like this is nothing yet. So that makes me excited.
Can you confirm or deny that? Does it get ridiculous?
Does it get ridiculous?
it definitely gets ridiculous. But I would like to, you know, so I'm curious because now that you've seen 1, 2, and 3, what are some of your favorite things about 1, 2, and 3 as that you've seen so far?
For me personally, the special effects are amazing, and I think they have been since season one. But I feel like so far in this season, now it's like I feel like things are starting to make more sense, but you're also starting to get to know the characters better. So now you're like, I'm starting to become more invested in them. But I also am starting to like them more. Like, I think Naomi is such a boss, and I have like such a girl crush on her now.
Wait till you see the season unfold. Naomi has some incredible work.
And
in this. I'm starting to
like Amos more too. Like, because now I'm starting to see more of him. Like, before I really just didn't think he was like this mindless like grunt, like, oh, I'm gonna beat people up, and like I didn't understand his attachment to Naomi. But a lot of what you said about when you were like researching it and had the therapist reading the churn and with the attachment therapy, the second you said that, because I've read up on that, it suddenly so much made much more sense about him. And I actually am probably going to go home and watch the episode again with all of that in mind, because it's starting to make more sense. And now I feel like I have to go back to season one and rewatch some stuff, which I love when that happens.
This is a show that rewards rewatching.
Yeah.
Something that does well the second and third time out.
And honestly, like the best stuff, whether it's a movie or a TV show or even like an album, I feel like you can always tell how good it is because every time you watch it or listen to it or read it again, you pick up something you missed the first time and you have like a deeper appreciation for it. And I feel like all the things that I'm a huge fan of, I'm able to rewatch them over and over again. And whether it's, you know, Star Wars or like Battlestar Galactica or like certain books or albums, I can always go back to them and I'm always coming out of it a bigger fan than last time. So I can definitely see how this show fits into that.
I have two main things for season two so far. One, I am a big Bobby Draper fan from the books, and seeing her on screen has been amazing so far. We were just talking earlier about her cold cocking somebody in this episode and how cool that was.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is Stephen Strait's abdominal muscles.
He's obsessed.
He's a beautiful
man. That's the best special effect
like,
on
he
the show.
Is seriously, this is nonstop. And it was definitely, I know the thought was going to be like, I was not going to stop. He won't stop. He keeps bringing it up.
And, I can't help it.
I mean, you're going to have to help it because it's going to get really weird when like we have.
If we ever actually do talk to Steven, it's just going to be really awkward.
And you know what? That's all Steven. There's no special effects or airbrushing. That's the real deal. That's Steven.
You're just making this
worse.
Looks
like a Greek god.
I just want to know the routine, man. I want to know how he does it and how I can get there. That's all.
Oh my God. He's
right,
like a lot younger than you.
That's true. That helps.
We'll start
too.
With that. So, but I heard that you have some impressive abs too. Dominique was giving you props last week.
Well, I'm glad she did, but it's not, you know,
like,
it's not easy
nothing.
With, yeah.
It's nothing when Adonis is next to me.
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I was like, how about we not do the shirt off scene? Yeah.
But I hope you're able to make time for us as the season progresses to like be a guest back.
Yeah, we'll check back in
again.
With you in the future.
Oh, you know, absolutely. This is something that, you know, this being a part of the show and being a part of this world is something that I really love. And we don't always we don't always love what we do, and sometimes it's work, and sometimes you don't want to do all the press around it. If you know, but this is something that, you know, if I needed to go to a Ralph's opening and ribbon cutting to promote the show, and it's going to help the show, I'd be willing to do it. So I'm willing to do, you know. So, but I think that you know, it's a joy to talk about it, and especially people that are truly, you know, fans and connect to the show. It's really great.
Oh, that's awesome. And I know the fans definitely appreciate it. I have people tweeting Belter to me now because of this, the podcast. And I'm probably, I was like, I'm going to have to know what they're saying. Because I'm like, there's no way to translate this on Twitter. I don't really know what they're saying to me. So I'm going to have to bone up on my
Brush
Belter.
Up your Belter.
Yeah, definitely. But Wes, thank you so much. We'll definitely be, you know, reaching out to you again. And I look forward to see where Amos goes.
Anytime. And I really enjoyed it. And thank you for having me.
Of course.
Hey, thank you, Wes. We appreciate it. It's always so interesting. Some of the people who play like the most, you know, crazy psycho. I wouldn't call him crazy psycho, but definitely
intense.
They're intense yeah. characters end up being the nicest people. Wes is certainly one of those guys.
He's a sweetheart, but he's not somebody you should probably try to push down and take their lunch money.
Yeah, no, hugging him is like hugging a table. He's just solid.
So we covered a lot of Wes. Let's actually now. I want to talk a bit about Miller, and I want to talk about the Mormons. And I know there was no smooth segue into that, but I personally found this really interesting because I find it interesting how religion is playing a role in this. And we're starting to just kind of have it teased. But I always think it's interesting in any sci-fi property whenever the religious aspect comes into play. What made you choose first the Mormons?
So the honest answer is...
Is it the planet that they get thing?
No. It's the honest answer is very sort of economic. It's when I was working on the game that the book is based on, around that time, I have a lot of Mormon friends and stuff. And one of the things that was a topic of a lot of conversation was the fact that the Mormon Church basically just bought the entire downtown Salt Lake City. To turn it into, a bunch of stuff related to their central temple there. And nobody knows for sure how much it cost, but the numbers that were flying around were in the billions of dollars. And I just found it fascinating that there's this church that, you know, I mean, I know a lot of people who are Mormon and stuff, but it's not by no means the biggest church around, and had this enormous capital to spend on a project that they thought was important. So then when I'm working on the game, I wanted there to be a generation ship that was under construction. It was important to sort of the plot of what was going on. And I just had this moment where I was sitting there thinking, who builds a generation ship? You know, you have to have enormous strength of purpose and unity of purpose, and you have to have a shit ton of money. And that was happening while this you know, thing with the church buying up all of downtown Salt Lake City happened. And it just popped into my head, you know, who would build a generation ship? The Mormons would, because they have money, they have enormous unity of purpose. And if that as a group, they decided, you know what, we should go explore another planet. Let's build a giant generation ship and send a bunch of Mormons on it to settle on another world. I can totally see their church getting behind that.
Yeah.
And that's really the only reason. That's where it all came from. It was just sort of, you know, the economics of it and the fact that they had done this thing in Salt Lake.
And you know, when I came into the project, that was already in place. That was already part of the game and the world building. But it made sense to me. There was just that sense of faith and optimism that don't always travel together. That seems to be necessary to dig into a project like that.
Yeah, and it's important to note. I mean, I've had people ask me if we're using the Mormons as comic relief or making fun of them, and it's actually the exact opposite. I'm not Mormon. I'm not religious at all. But I've always sort of viewed the building of that ship as this really impressive act of faith, and it's very aspirational, and in many ways, it's kind of beautiful. And the fate of that ship is one of the great tragedies of the series. So it's not intended to be mockery. It's actually intended to, in some ways, it's a it's me being impressed by the sort of unity, what unity of purpose can do.
I was going to ask in particular if you'd had any reaction from Mormon fans of the book or the show.
We have had some folks who have reached out to us, and generally speaking, it's been quite positive. And it is important to us that we're not making fun of anybody for their religion or for a philosophy that we don't personally share. And I think that came through pretty well in the book and in the show.
Yeah, that is really important to us. And in the first season, when we were shooting some of the early scenes, I think it was the scene where Fred is in the construction pod with the Mormon guy and they're discussing work stoppage on the ship in the first season. We actually had a friend of mine who is Mormon on set with us. And she, you know, she was giving me sort of pointers and notes on the Mormon wouldn't describe himself that way. He would use this other term and that kind of stuff. And that made it into the show. So, you know, taking that stuff, you know, treating that stuff with respect is part of, it's important to us. In the third book, we have a character who's a Methodist minister, and I have a friend who is a Methodist minister, and I ran all of the Pastor Anna chapters past her and got her notes and you know, listened to her her feedback on it.
And on the other side of that coin, can you talk a bit about the research around generation ships and the Nauvoo? I mean, where that concept came from and how deep you went into developing that as a concept on the show and in books?
I've read a lot of sci-fi, and of course, one of the things that shows up in sci-fi a lot is the concept of the generation ship. But really, the Nauvoo is Babylon 5 with an engine on it. I mean, honestly, that's what it is.
Yep.
It's like, how would you build a generation ship? Well, I'd build a big rotating drum that I could have farms in and just stick an engine on one end.
And then fire it off the right place and just make sure the loss tolerances are really, really small, really tight. Part of the thing that is important, and we don't talk about this a whole lot, is the payoff that we get from having the technology be plausible. You know, even if we're not perfectly accurate, the getting between one star and another isn't something we can do. The idea of interstellar travel in a human lifetime poses insoluble problems. So this is reaching for the kind of solution where it's like, well, okay, we can't get there quickly. How can we get there by just committing ourselves and our children and our grandchildren and their children and their children and their children, and then somebody will get there, but it won't be us. That's that sense of constraint, that sense of storytelling that comes out of trying to make this accurate to within an approximation of the kinds of problems that you see when we're looking at the real thing.
So I'm going to, again, switch gears because I actually want to ask about now Christian and her motivation when she's reaching out to Fred Johnson. And again, like obviously readers in the books, they already know what's going on and what's going to happen. But up until now, it's still hard to kind of see what her end game is. Like, can you talk a little bit about that and like how much more we're going to get into her and like what she's playing at over the next couple episodes without spoiling anything? Or
because she was the one who suggested Deimos, right, as the target. And then her reaction to it in this episode seemed pretty upset that it happened.
It's literally almost every single time she's on screen, it's conflicting with the previous time she's on screen. So you really just don't know what her end game is, whose side she's really on. I mean, I know ultimately she's thinking in the best interests of Earth, you know?
Yeah. What she's trying to do is survive what she recognizes is one of the most dangerous moments in human history. You know, I mean, there are times we look back on the Cold War, you know, the Earth Mars thing has got a lot of Cold War in it. And we look back on the Cold War and we read articles now about, you know, in 1981, you know, we didn't know it, but political tensions were at an all-time high. And then there was a weather balloon flew across Russia. And weather balloon flew across Russia. They were one key turn away from launching their arsenal. You know, you read about that and you're like, oh, my God, that's terrifying. But it happened in the past. What we're trying to show is that she's in one of those moments. And she's the only person who recognizes it. And she's tap dancing around to try to keep, she's trying to keep the body count down. You know, the whole thing with Demos is she's in the room watching them argue for war. You know, Aaron Wright saying, we can knock all of their ships down. Admiral Wynn is saying, yeah, we can win this fight. And she sees if this conversation keeps going, it ends with the fleets engaging and then the planets glassing each other with missiles and the end of civilization. She sees that's where it's going. She offers up Demos because she knows it will satisfy their bloodlust, and she doesn't think the Martians will immediately go to war for it. And in fact, that's a conversation she has with
Admiral Souther
in the bar later, is it's the smallest move they would accept and it would still satisfy their need to do something. And really the whole thing about reaching out to Fred is she's desperately looking for allies. All the people who traditionally were her allies, she's losing. Souther has stepped down as the commander of the fleet and gone off to Jupiter. Aaron Wright, she's come to discover, is absolutely playing for the wrong team. She just doesn't have anyone she can count on anymore. Anybody who seems to be on the same side that she's on. And the one thing, you know, she's looking into Fred and she realizes maybe this is the one guy who's playing his cards up. He's playing his cards straight up. He is actually doing what he says he's going to do and is telling the truth. And maybe he can be an ally for me here.
And part of what, I mean, we talked about this last time. Part of the point of the project is arguing that both sides have good and bad people on them. And Avisarala is not in a position right now where she's safe with her own people.
How much do you think current events being what they are is going to actually kind of like help the show? Because it really feels like sometimes like we're talking about stuff and I'm like, oh, this could literally be like my Twitter timeline right now. Like,
knowing what I know about the season, I hope very little.
Yeah, let it be nothing like that at all, please. Yeah.
Yeah. If the headlines were nothing like the rest of the season, that would make my day-to-day life more pleasant. but part of what happens when you come into a project like this, especially because I'm working with Ty, and Ty is, among other things, a student of history. History has these patterns in it, and it has these issues that come up in it over and over and over again. And those absolutely informed what we did with the plots and the structures of the books and of the show. And we're in a moment in history now that, you know, rhymes with a bunch of the stuff that has come before and a bunch of the stuff that we drew from. I can hope that we as citizens and as artists and as human beings possessed of will and conscience can do a good job with the historical moment we've got. And I hope that it pulls us a little bit farther away from the worst things that happen in the stuff we made up.
It's a little much.
Let's just hope the Holdens and the Avisaralas win. That's in the real world.
So do we have any, you guys have any shout outs for this week? I know last week we shouted out The Good Place, or you shouted out The Good Place. What are you into now? What do you want to shout out in the sci-fi universe or genre verse?
I've been playing a lot of The Darkest Dungeon on my PlayStation.
Yeah, the one that was coming up for me was Darkest Dungeon, actually. I think it's the perfect balance of sort of the role-playing and the resource allocation and management thing that really, I think, scratches it. It looks fun. I mean, I've only watched a little bit, but...
Well, and it's got a real H.P. Lovecraft kind of mythos to it, very Cthulhu-esque, which I usually appreciate.
It's basically a game where you are managing teams of heroes that you send into a dungeon. It's a roguelike in that aspect because they just go into these dungeons and have adventures, but they come back like traumatized and scarred, and you have to manage their emotional states at the inn and everything. It's really great. It's a lot of fun.
Nothing about that sounds fun.
I mean, we were talking about Wes with his PTSD, and one of the things that's funny about this is you know, whenever I play role-playing games, like in my first level adventure goes into the basement and is attacked by a giant spider, my first thought is, if that really happened to me, I went down in a basement and like a 3-foot wide spider jumped out of a hole, I would spend the rest of my life on a therapy sketch. Like that would just be it for me. And so, like, but it never happens. You know, your adventure is like, oh, 3-foot spider, no problem. I'll hit it with my stick. The thing with Darkest Dungeon is it totally plays with that. It's like, you just went through a dungeon and fought horrible monsters. Now you have to come back and, like, you know, go on a therapist couch because you're dealing with the trauma of that. It's something I've never seen a game like that do before.
Yeah, it's like when the resource management you were talking about, it's one of the resources is the emotional state of your heroes.
So it's like Sims meets RPG.
It's like Call of Cthulhu as an RPG. There are games with that mechanic elsewhere, but this one, it does it gracefully, and it's fun. And, you know, I was watching Ty talk about, trying to maintain the mix of adventurers so that, you know, you always have some people who are mentally stable enough to do the next thing.
Did you guys ever play Eternal Darkness back in the day on the Nintendo? I think it was Nintendo 64 or GameCube. I can't remember which, but that was a game where you could go crazy too from the horrors that you were facing. And it really did it in a lot of fun ways. Like, it would mess with your screen. Your character's head would just pop off for no reason. It was crazy.
You're so bizarre. I'm so new to, like, the RPG thing. I just started playing RPGs, a year and a half ago with, or 2 years ago with Dragon Age Inquisition, because Adam suggested it. And then that was, like, all I did for a month. But yeah, I can't really find, it's hard for me to get into RPGs. So I don't know that this is going to be one of them.
Well, Darkest Dungeon is more of a roguelike than a story-driven RPG. There's really no big.
Yeah, I like story-driven.
Yeah. But it's still great.
Since we're talking a little bit about H.P. Lovecraft, though, let me just also shout out, there's a novella called The Ballad of Black Tom that is a different take on a classic H.P. Lovecraft story. I read the two of them, the original and the Ballad of Black Tom, back to back last year. And it was really interesting to watch that reinterpretation and recontextualizing of H.P. Lovecraft's work, which I think H.P. Lovecraft really begs for.
Okay.
Very cool.
Two good shout outs. All right, guys. Well, thank you once again for making time to break down this episode with us. And for everyone out there listening, make sure you subscribe on iTunes and give us the highest rating possible. 5 stars, 5 stars, 5 stars. You can always tweet at us or find us on Twitter and Facebook at Sci-Fi Wire. If you have any questions or, you know, anything that you want to give us feedback wise, and, you know, keep watching social media because we'll be announcing, you know, upcoming guests on upcoming episodes. And we'll see you guys next week. So peace out.